From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with poet, essayist, and translator J. Chester Johnson, whose new memoir is Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre, and a Story of Reconciliation, published by Simon & Schuster Pegasus. He is the author of several celebrated poetry collections and nonfiction work, and was one of two poets, the other being W.H. Auden, on the drafting committee for the retranslated Psalms in the Book of Common Prayer. Johnson also served as Deputy Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Treasury Department under Jimmy Carter. He lives in New York City with his wife. His new book, Damaged Heritage, concerns an illuminating journey to racial reconciliation experienced by two Americans, one black and one white. The 1919 Elaine Race Massacre, arguably the worst in our country's history, has been widely unknown for the better part of a century, thanks to the whitewashing of history. In 2008, Johnson was asked to write the Litany of Offense and Apology for a National Day of Repentance, where the Episcopal Church formally apologized for its role in transatlantic slavery and related evils. In his research, Johnson came upon a treatise by historian and anti-lynching advocate Ida B. Wells on the Elaine Massacre, where more than 100 and possibly hundreds of African-American men, women, and children perished at the hands of white posses, vigilantes, and federal troops in rural Phillips County, Arkansas. As he worked, Johnson would discover that his beloved grandfather had participated in the massacre. The discovery shook him to his core. Determined to find some way to acknowledge and reconcile this terrible truth, Chester would eventually meet Sheila L. Walker, a descendant of African-American victims of the massacre. She herself had also been on her own migration in family history that led straight to the Elaine Race Massacre. Together, she and Johnson committed themselves to a journey of racial reconciliation and abiding friendship. Damaged Heritage brings to light a deliberately erased chapter in American history, and Chester offers a blueprint for how our pluralistic society can at last acknowledge and deal with damaged heritage and follow a path to true healing. In speaking with Chester, I began by reading from the introduction of Damaged Heritage, and our conversation went from there. I hope you find it interesting. You write, "In today's America, it is not enough for white folks to identify the damaged heritage of their ancestors. Rather, it is critical at this time for white Americans to establish and enunciate the marked and unalloyed differences in attitude and practice between that past and their own actions. That is what can be done affirmatively in setting a juxtaposition with that past, that damaged heritage." And, you know, I feel like it's so important for people to have a starting point for what they do now in their lives. And I thought that was a good starting point for us as well.
Well, thank you for starting there. It's you sort of encapsulized the approach that I've taken in the book as a whole, because we began the book, but also in terms of American racism, starts with the issue of damaged heritage. While in my case, it is my maternal grandfather in particular who participated in this race massacre, but it's not just that. It is an accumulation of our past, our inheritance. I mean, I didn't necessarily participate in let's use the Elaine Race Massacre as an example, but it is part of my inheritance, and if I don't deal with it, then I sort of foist it into the future, and laying it off on future generations. And if you don't mind, maybe I could just talk briefly about what damaged heritage is.
Absolutely.
Damaged heritage, if you step back and look at it generationally, is an essential feature of American racism. It is that sort of ingrained, prejudicial tradition and custom, and that's sometimes codified into law. But it's also, from a historical point of view, combined with this not infrequent, but gratuitous and sometimes actually savage or severe violence and repression by American whites, or perpetrated by American whites against African Americans. I mean, that's sort of the larger perspective of what has been this this damaged heritage that we've had foisted on us from generation to generation. And that's where I start from the book. I had not called the book Damaged Heritage, but as in those sort of wee hours of the morning before you sort of in your subconscious, Damaged Heritage kept popping in my head. And then I had lunch with my literary agent for the book, and he had been reading galleys of the thing, and he said, "Have you ever thought about calling this Damaged Heritage?" And so that's how we came up with the with the title. And I but there's so much Damaged Heritage, and the quote that you read is just the beginning of this. It's an identity that it identifies it what it is, but it doesn't deal with what we can do about it. And I try in this book to address those issues of what can be done about it in the context of whites in particular, relating to that event, but I mean related to Damaged Heritage, but also what have we done with Damaged Heritage? And I come from the Mississippi River Delta, and I come from Southeast Arkansas, and it is a very racist region. So my view on the way in which people deal with Damaged Heritage is maybe extreme, but it's not unlike the country as a whole. It's just a little bit more glaring than what we experience in the country as a whole. But what I argue in this book is that white folks cannot, from generation to generation, could not actually confront this damaged heritage as human beings without some kind of protection. See, I actually believe that my forebears knew what they were doing, and that they knew that this was wrong. But they had the cover of what is this excessive veneration of the past, and the except which served as sort of an antidote, it inoculated those generations from participating in Damaged Heritage. They could bring it forward because it was sort of forgiven by virtue of this, it goes by a fancy name, yeah, filial pietism. But that's what it is. It's this excessive veneration of ancestors and tradition.
Yeah. Now your grandfather, your maternal grandfather, who you mentioned before, Lonnie, was an important figure in in your life and in writing this book. He's now passed away, but you write that your mother frequently referred to Lonnie after he had died as having been a member of the Ku Klux Klan, and then you later learned that he had been involved in the Elaine race massacre. You know, and squaring this kind and loving grandfather with this other story created a really painful contradiction for you, and I think in a lot of ways that was the starting point of a journey for you that you write about in the book. So I thought we could talk about that next, and I think that, you know, that is all very tied into what you're saying about damaged heritage and what we inherit from our ancestors, or don't,
yeah.
or choose not to.
Right, exactly, unfortunately. You know, it's kind of hard to be white in the in America and not have some direct or indirect exposure to damaged heritage. But you're right. My father died when I was one, and my mother didn't do well for a few years, and so I lived with my maternal grandparents, and Lonnie had just retired from the Missouri Pacific Railroad, which actually, while he was working for them, was up to its eyeballs in this massacre, this Elaine race massacre. And people, family members said I was his 24-hour retirement project, which was true. I lived, you know, for the first 5 years of my life, I lived with him, and he took care of me, mm-hmm. and he was loving, he was adoring, I adored him. And then, my mother had mentioned this particular event. She called it a race riot, and she discussed that there were a large number of African Americans who were killed, and she described sort of roughly where it happened and that sort of thing. But I didn't really focus on it until 2008. And I know that sounds rather a long time from her telling me about it until I really focused on it. But I was asked by the Episcopal Church to write the Litany of Offense, an apology for the church's role in transatlantic slavery and related evils. And as I was doing my research, I came across this treatise that had been written by the African-American historian and anti-lynching advocate Ida B. Wells, and she called it the Arkansas Race Riot of 1919. And I was really fascinated by it. I mean, I grew up one county removed from this event, and I never heard anything about it. And I didn't hear about it in school, didn't hear it in church, didn't hear it in social gatherings, you know, and except for my mother alluding to this event that she called a race riot, I never would have, I just hadn't heard about it. And I actually was a bit offended. I mean, I felt, you know, this event became an evanescence. I mean, it had disappeared, and all these African Americans had died and all of that. But as I constructed all of this together and did research as to what other killings had occurred within Southeast Arkansas against African Americans after World War I, they were scattered. But it was only maybe one or two people. There wasn't but one major massacre in that part of Arkansas during that period of time. So I eventually joined that. I concluded that the Elaine race massacre, the massacre that Ida B. Wells had written about, and the one that my mother was telling me about were one and the same. I won't go through all the facts related to all of that, but I mean, I concluded it. But what also was brought forward is my grandfather's role in it. And so here I am. We grow up in this country thinking that we can sort of almost reconcile anything. I mean, if we just temper it enough, and we And in any case, I over time, it was very disturbing to me. I ended up bifurcating the two Lonnies, that there was this, I couldn't bring them together. I just simply couldn't bring them together. There was the adoring grandfather, and then there was the gunman who participated in this massacre of African American.
We should talk a little bit about what the massacre was, because it was around African Americans trying to unionize to get better pay for their work, and basically they were attacked by posses and vigilantes and federal troops ultimately. Do you want to just talk a little bit about that as well, just so people kind of have a context of what we're talking about?
After World War One, African Americans came back from Europe having defended this country, and many of them being heroic, they assumed that they would be treated better than they had been prior to leaving the shores. Whites rose up all throughout the country saying that's just not going to happen, and racial conflicts broke out all the way from Arizona to New England, and journalists domestically and foreign called what we were going through a race war. And in the Mississippi River Delta, it was worse, particularly in terms of whites' response to African Americans. And as these veterans came to Mississippi River Delta into Phillips County, very rich area for cotton, and bear in mind, cotton prices at that time were extraordinarily high, higher than anyone had sort of dreamed of for years and years. It was 50 cents a pound, which was really extraordinary. And the sharecroppers wanted to be able to sell at the maximum level so that they could pay off their debts at the commissary and maybe free themselves from virtual indentured servitude and being tied to this land. And in order to get what and the feelings between sharecroppers and the white planters and the white establishment as a whole was very poor at this time, and mainly for the reasons I just identified. But the sharecroppers decided to enter into, as you alluded to, the union, Progressive Farmers and Household Union. And on the evening of September the 30th, 1919, they were having their sort of final organization meeting at Hoopspur Church, which is just north of Elaine, when the deputy sheriff and a representative of the Missouri Pacific Railroad arrived in Model T Ford, and they got out of the car and started shooting into the church to disrupt the proceedings. They did not know that there were guards that the union had hired to defend the night's proceedings, and those guards shot back. The Missouri Pacific representative was killed, and the deputy sheriff was hit in the knee. The sheriff makes it back to the county seat, tells the sheriff what had happened. Sheriff begins to deputize and send out posses. The following morning, October 1, the posses begin to shoot sharecroppers in and around Hoopspur area where the sharecroppers were living. But there were two whites killed in that exchange. One can make the argument that both of them were by friendly fire, but mm-hmm. that's a different story. But the sheriff then calls up the governor, says, well, we've got a black insurrection occurring over here. They have guns, and they outnumber us, and we need those federal troops located at Fort Pike. The governor calls the War Department, Woodrow Wilson, which was Woodrow Wilson administration, which was notoriously racist, any case, and they, so those troops were released, and they made their way following day, October the 2nd, to Phillips County to restore order. Now, they brought with them, the troops brought with them machine guns, and there's no question that the vast number of killings that occurred in this massacre were inflicted by the by those machine guns.
Just to be clear, not that it was an illegal meeting to unionize, but just to be clear, they weren't shooting necessarily at people they knew had been at the meeting. They were shooting sort of randomly at any sharecroppers. Is that correct?
That's right. That's right. They just came out. The killing fields were primarily in the middle of the cotton fields, and are in coppices or sloughs or that were adjacent to or ran through the cotton fields. And we know that somewhere in the range of 60 to 80 African Americans were killed, according to an FBI report that was completed almost immediately after the end of the conflict and submitted to the Justice Department. But the Wilson administration, being what it was, put that report away. Now, the one thing I neglected to refer to is, in addition to the vigilantes and deputies and the deputized white folks, that men who went out to shoot African Americans, and in addition to the military, vigilantes came from surrounding communities, white vigilantes from surrounding communities, Mississippi and Tennessee, to participate. And they just sort of drove through the county and shooting African Americans at random, many of whom had not even heard what was going on at what had happened at Hoop Spur, but were just killed because they were black. And so we know that, you know, well over 100 and possibly hundreds of African Americans were killed.
And that's the conflict
as a result.
That's the conflict that you learned your grandfather was most likely involved in.
That's right.
Now,
that's right.
Now another aspect of the book, an important aspect of the book, is the idea of reconciliation. And to that end, I was wondering if you could talk about another important person in your life, who is Sheila L. Walker, an African-American woman who, like you, had family members in her past who were involved in the Elaine Race Massacre. But Sheila is, as I said, black, and she had antecedents who were victims, and the two of you have met. And I thought that was an incredible story, and I wonder if you can talk about that a little bit.
Well, thank you. Yes, we both had been pursuing more and more information about the massacre independently. And then one writer who has spent also a lot of time on this and coming up with actually what went on at various points in time leading up to the massacre and what happened then, he suggested that Sheila and I meet each other. And so our first contact, I called her, and we talked for like 2 hours, and then we decided that we should meet, and we met in Boston. Her son was her son lives there with his family, and so we met there, and it was almost an immediate recognition of the need for the two of us to achieve racial reconciliation. And that was 6 years ago. And that has sort of a fancy name of racial reconciliation. What it really did was we developed a very close friendship. And our spouses have participated in it. Our children have participated in it. We are just very close. And one thing that happened that made it all possible, and I explain this in some detail and its importance in the book, And that is that soon after we began to be on this journey, Sheila and I, who Sheila wrote the foreword, as a matter of fact, the book, Lonnie, to me, began to sort of create this shadow over, because how do I deal with Lonnie? I mean, Lonnie participated. He was my beloved grandfather. How do we relate? And Sheila, both publicly and privately, I mean, first time she did, we were at a symposium on this, and we were talking about the massacre, and she said, you know, I forgive Lonnie. He was a loving, compassionate person. He in some ways produced Chester and Chester's feelings about his grandfather and about this whole issue of what we do with this inheritance. He had to be a loving and compassionate person, but bad circumstances make good people do bad things. And that was her line. And
that must have sort of blown you away in that moment. That's one of the most generous things I've ever heard. Were you shocked by that?
Yes, I was shocked. I also felt I needed some instruction on how you forgive. I've concluded that we white folks don't do very well, even in the acceptance of forgiveness. I know if you look at what happened at Mother Emanuel Church down in Charleston and all those relatives of the victims of, you know, said, we're forgiving Roof, Dylan Roof, who was the gunman. You know, I mean, it shocked everybody. Whites particularly were astonished by it. But I realized that she was much further along in terms of reconciling Lonnie, and I still am not sure that I fully forgive Lonnie. But she has been, you know, helping in that respect because of, you know, through our friendship and et cetera. But it's been a blessing, the relationship that we have had, and in fact, a friend wrote me a letter after reading the book and said, you know, Chester, I have an idea about solving our race problem. We need to have millions of the relationships throughout this country. There are many people of goodwill. We just need to get black folks and white folks together like you and Sheila. Yeah. And there's a certain truth to
there
that.
Is.
But it's there is, and but it's been very meaningful.
Now, obviously, because you write about your relationship and the reconciliation ideas, this book is also a memoir in a way, as you include your own journey to understanding Lonnie's involvement and also your work toward building, having a memorial built that might mark the 100th anniversary of the Elaine Race Massacre, and help future generations learn and remember this event that people weren't educated about earlier, as you've pointed out. So I sort of see Damaged Heritage as a kind of scholarly historical memoir. And I wondered how it was for you, and I don't think we've mentioned that you are a poet. How was it for you to write this book?
In some ways, it was very hard. Not necessarily from the structural point of view of writing it, but revisiting times in my life where racism really dominated my life, and revisiting that was painful in many ways, and having to go back and then even thinking about, do I forgive Lonnie for his role, and working my way through all of that and coming to conclusions. As you mentioned, I was very involved in the creation of the memorial for Elaine Race Massacre, because there had been no physical, permanent physical memorial, and we had, it's an absolutely gorgeous structure, and it was dedicated the end of September, close to the centennial, and I was a co-chair of the group that put the memorial together. And I think that it's important physically for a variety of reasons. One is that it gives, because there hasn't been reconciliation locally about this issue between whites and blacks. And in fact, one African American man said, you know, for year, all we've done the last 100 years is sweep this under the rug, but then we keep stumbling over the rug. And that I think is an accurate representation of what happened. And then as a side note, I find this interesting. In relationship, there was a demonstration in Phillips County related to George Floyd. And guess where they had the demonstration? You know, at the memorial. So it's become a significant symbolic value locally, and it's one of the more important things I've ever done, was participate in that way. But it becomes part of the book. I mean, I spend considerable time, because actually Sheila and I in April of 2017 went down to speak about reconciliation, because the county really has had major problems with black-white relationships and in dealing with this massacre. And so an organization sponsored us to talk about our reconciliation, which we did. And these were whites and blacks, but also people from the rest of the state came as well to hear this. And this was part of the development of the program for the physical memorial as well. So it has, you know, this has lots of different, the memorial itself has a lot of different tentacles, but all of which really being very, very important.
Now, you just mentioned George Floyd, and I did want to ask you about that. I imagine you're speaking or writing quite a lot now about the protests and the deaths of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor and Ahmaud Arbery, maybe not writing directly about those incidents, but just about the present time in our history. And I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about that and how this has affected what you are thinking and writing.
Well, I'll start from the point of view that I had some discussions with African Americans in Phillips County as I was finishing up on this book. And in the interview, one interview, African American man said, you know, the attitudes that are present in our country now are similar attitudes that existed in 1919. And I was sort of shocked by it. And I said, you know, tell me, what are you referring to? And he was saying, well, you know, you look at the value of lives and African American lives, and that, you know, it's part of the world that we're living in today, and how they're less valuable than whites, the way in which whites can actually kill African Americans with an understanding that can be done with impunity. Or at least perception of impunity, and those are not dissimilar to what happened in 1919. I mean, there were all these African Americans killed, over 100 and maybe hundreds, but no whites were indicted or charged with anything. It ended up being. And for the five deaths of white persons as part of the violence, you know, there were 74 African Americans convicted of various charges, from first-degree murder to night riding, right after the massacres, but no whites had to do it. You know, had to serve and whatever. And it just, you know, it, that attitude is present today. I mean, that is what, you know, this person told me, and it required me to really focus on that. And I ultimately had to, you know, it's a matter of gradations. We wouldn't necessarily have the same reaction from the judicial system if that were to happen today. But there, you know, the issue of value of African American lives and the extent to which whites think that they can take African American lives with impunity or close to impunity, you know, those threads are still very present in our current race relations.
Right. And what you just said reminds me that we should tell listeners that your book, I think maybe it's a lot to get into for our discussion, but they should know that the massacre concluded with a Supreme Court decision ultimately. There's a lot about the court cases, and there's a lot about the judicial system at that time, which I thought was really interesting. And two important figures in the trial one character we certainly already know, Oliver Wendell Holmes, and then there was an African-American lawyer named Scipio Africanus Jones, who sounded like just an absolutely extraordinary person. So, I mean, I don't think we can talk at length about the court case, but do you have anything you want to say about Scipio Africanus Jones?
Oh, yes, I do. As a matter of fact, you know, I dedicated the book to three people, and I dedicated it to his memory, knowing that he will someday be the American hero that he deserves to be. Just extraordinary. You know, in summary, the 74 sharecroppers who were found guilty of those various crimes and were either scheduled to be executed state prison or serving time in Cummins Prison Farm, within 5 years, all 74 were free. And in addition, I'll just allude to this, in that case, the Moore versus Dempsey, it set a precedent for equal justice under the law that the civil rights movement really relied on for its future. And this is, and Scipio wrote the brief for it. I mean, he didn't get to present it at the Supreme Court, but he wrote it. And, you know, there's nothing in Arkansas now that really memorializes him in any way. There used to be a high school in North Little Rock named after him, but then they closed that high school. So there's really nothing, and I'm just hopeful that there'll be a serious biography someday that will really give attention to him. I mean, he worked with Thurgood Marshall. In fact, Marshall took over when he died. He took several of the civil rights cases that Scipio had been working on. Here's a person who started out in life as a laborer, whose mother was black, his father was probably white, and owned his mother. He was a farm hand in Tulip, Arkansas, and by the time he was in his mid-20s, he had become a lawyer through actually the help of three white lawyers, and became really an institution in the state. White judges would turn to him when they had to, you know, they would be on vacation or whatever, and he would, you know, he would sit as judge for them, and he was very well respected on both sides. The white and the blacks never actually, in Arkansas, actually never lost the right to vote. I mean, there locally, maybe some things happened that kept them, but Scipio, when all of that was happening in other southern states, he created this movement, this campaign that eventually won the blacks' right to vote in Arkansas. And He's just an extraordinary man. I mean, it's just all you have to do is look at what he did with this particular case, where he spent 5 years on it, and all 74 were free at the end of that time in an incredibly hostile environment.
Right.
I mean, much more hostile than the one that we face. It's just an amazing, amazing person. And I just know that he hasn't been given the attention that he should in history. And I'm very hopeful that someone soon will write a decent biography of him.
I wonder, Chester, if you wouldn't mind if I read a quote from the book. This really stood out for me, and it really, I don't know, it was a metaphor that clarified a lot for me. I don't know that I have a question about it, but I just wanted to read it so people get a sense of your writing as well. Is that okay if I read it?
Sure, absolutely.
So, and this is actually an excerpt of a longer paragraph, but you write, "Over the 7 decades of my life, facing racial division and white subjugation of blacks, I have witnessed time and again the unwanted reason we whites have little capacity to cleanse ourselves for the execution of continuous harm by whites against blacks, built up so much scar tissue over the years and generations that it became impossible for the perpetrators to penetrate into their humanity through those layers of tragedy." And I'm going to stop there. It goes on. But it was such a moment for me of clarity about damaged heritage. And it's hard work to overcome it. It's hard work to reconcile. And I just thought that was a real moment in the book.
Well, thank you. It's also important in the context of what you read to realize that because we whites have had the difficulty of penetrating into our own humanity because of this damaged heritage that we've accumulated over the years, is that that's why filial pietism, or this excessive veneration of the past, works so well for American whites, and particularly Southerners, in being able to proceed and rely on that past to continue to commit the racism and the acts of racism that exist not only today, but clearly in the past. I just found that to be, as I thought through this and using my history that I have in this whole area, that I concluded that paragraph that you read is so illustrative of why we have needed the filial pietism in order to keep this diabolical system. Mm-hmm. An interesting vignette is I've read a lot of Faulkner over the years, and it seems to me that Faulkner was sort of probably the most exceedingly filial pietistic writer in maybe American history, because he brought all those mythologies forward. And in Intruder in the Dust, he wrote this line that is really compatible with what you read. And he said, but it's a combination. He recognizes the combination of damaged heritage and filial pietism. And it's really fascinating, because that is what he made his living and doing, was writing about that. But this is the quote. It says, "No man can cause more grief than that one clinging blindly to the vices of his ancestors." So even though, you know, that's what his writing brought it, you know, the mythologies forward and bringing it current. I mean, you know, he was the one who tailored that line of the past is never dead, it's not even past. And his writings did that. But but at the same time, he realized what tragic combination of those two things can lead to for whites.
Yeah. the show is for writers as well as readers. And so I always like to end by asking an advice sort of question. And in your case, I thought I might ask if you have any advice for writers who might be trying to work on a book of history that's combined with personal history.
Well, yeah, I guess I do. Before I do that, I want to mention one thing, though. A former governor, his name was Jim Douglas, told me once that there are more writers per square foot in Vermont than any place else on the in the United States. So I assume that's one of the reasons you have the number.
Yeah, well, it's true, there are more writers per capita in Vermont than in any other state, although I don't know that I've heard that updated, but that was true 20 years ago anyway.
Right, exactly. But I think that's when I heard it from him. But I don't mean this in an immodest way. It's really as a matter of guidance. But I wouldn't write anything that it didn't hurt to write. I don't know if it's worth very much if you don't pick those subjects that to write about that are invasive in a way that exposes yourself in some ways that you don't even realize until you've gotten deep into it. And yet I think that it was most worthwhile for me because I've been involved in civil rights and race issues and all of that, as you know, for a good portion of my life, as you know, by reading the book. But I had never really seen so much of the personal aspects of my life being contained within the context of race and civil rights in that way. And I realized it was, you know, it was painful in many ways to go through all of that, but it was worthwhile.
Okay, great. Thank you, Chester. I want to just mention again, the name of the book is Damaged Heritage by J. Chester Johnson and published by Pegasus Books.
It's published by Pegasus, but Simon & Schuster will be distributing the book.
Okay. Chester, thank you so much for speaking with me. I found the book absolutely fascinating, and I wish you all the best with it.
Well, thank you very much, and I hope you'll invite me back someday.
Oh, absolutely. We'll have to talk when you have the next one.
Okay. Very good.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with J. Chester Johnson about his new memoir, Damaged Heritage, The Elaine Race Massacre and a Story of Reconciliation, published by Simon & Schuster, Pegasus. You can learn more about Chester's work at his website, jchesterjohnson.com. This week's Write the Book prompt is to consider your own family's leanings when it comes to filial pietism, that veneration, often excessive, of ancestors or tradition about which J. Chester Johnson speaks in our interview. Does this exist in your own circle of relatives? Probably. Do people excuse behaviors because it's just how the family has always been? Do you or a loved one have beliefs based largely on what you were raised to think, but have never questioned? Are there even certain artifacts, maybe, hidden away in your home that you keep simply because they belonged to a great-grandfather or grandmother? If so, think about why they are there. Why do you believe what you believe? Why do you cling to what you cling to? What might you shed of your family's past, if anything, if you could? And then, after you've thought about these things, write about them. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. Bear Pond Books in Montpelier presents their Zoom Sci-Fi and Book Club meeting, which will be virtual. The book is Seven Eves by Neal Stephenson. That's tonight, June 15th at 7 p.m. For more information, RSVP to kimwardvermont@gmail.com. And then Bear Pond Books in Montpelier presents the book launch for Safe as Lightning, a poetry collection by recent Write the Book guest Scudder H. Parker, Thursday, June 18th at 7. More information at bearpondbooks.com. The Fletcher Free Library in Burlington presents an open-door virtual presentation with Kate DiCamillo and Jason Reynolds, June 18th at 7. More information at fletcherfree.org. The North Shire Bookstore in Manchester Center presents an at-home literary conversation, Rosalie Necht in conversation with Tracy O'Neill, Thursday, June 18th at 5. More information at northshire.com. And then the Sustainable Montpelier Coalition is holding a writing competition for creative people. Here's some information. Through the written word and graphic narrative, you can help change the future. Your creative ideas can serve as a model for Montpelier and surrounding towns. Your inspiring fiction, considered essay, or imaginative graphic story will focus on one day in the future in a climate-changed central Vermont. You will take the reader through time to a certain day of your choosing in 2047. With brevity and clarity, you'll imagine what that day looks and feels like. You'll offer a vision of innovations or responses that might have emerged between now and then. These imagined solutions will be both plausible and useful here in central Vermont. We hope your ideas can inspire the whole community. The deadline is June 23rd. More information is available at next.sustainablemontpelier.org. Each week in recent months, I've been speaking about the pandemic and quarantine and asking that each of you try to find the books that have come out even as book tours are being canceled. I still hope this. I still hope, too, that you're able to read and write in isolation. But even as we grapple with the pandemic, other important aspects of America are changing before our eyes. Today's interview touches on the tragic and shameful history of slavery and racial repression in this country. I am thinking a great deal about this lately, and more than ever, my message is to stay well and stay safe, but also stand up and fight for what you believe and write about what you believe, because that is protest too, and writing is as vital as it has ever been. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. If you like the show, rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook. All the other stuff, talk about it, all the other social media sites, it's all important to the word getting out about the show and people hearing it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We're also on all the podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have particularly good luck with one of our weekly Write the Book prompts, I'd love to see it. Send it to writethebook@gmail.com, and if there's time, I'll share it on the air. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Stay well, and have a great week.
America. This is the new America. We are the new America. This is the new America. We are the new America. This is the new America. We are the new America.
From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. We hope you're staying well and staying safe.